if we look at the areas where we're seeing growth, they continue to be in the premium, super premium, luxury in spirits and in beer and in wine.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Time I saw Luli Halsted, she was giving a talk in Stockholm. It was 2008 and she had the room absolutely captivated. Luli's got this great ability to take hard data and make you want to hang off every word. I've seen her give talks in London, Verona, Hong Kong, you name it, and she always manages to translate the world in an interesting way. Okay, so in case you need the introduction, Luli founded research firm Wine Intelligence in 2002, when the world didn't even know it needed wine data. It became a company with offices in numerous countries and was then acquired by research company IWSR, where she's now a non-executive director. But she also holds loads of positions, both honorary and substantive, and is everywhere, teaching, consulting, and speaking. Plus, she co-founded a vineyard in England in 2021, and she's opened another consultancy in Telemer. In this conversation, we talk about the global outlook for wine, and I learn a bunch of stuff I didn't know, including about the value of a French label. We also discuss other alcohol sectors and where the opportunities are. Remember, if you want the takeaways, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. Luli, welcome to the show.
Fantastic to see you, Felicity.
Right, before we started, you were telling me a startling statistic. Would you care to share that?
Yes. So to the 10 years to 2028, there will be a 20% reduction in the volume of wine consumed globally.
Oh, my God. Okay, what is that based on? Why?
Well, first of all, the data is based on IWSR, so it comes from IWSR market data and forecasts. Why? That's a longer answer that comes from a combination of macro trends, what is happening in total beverage alcohol, and then specifically what is happening in wine.
Okay, let's get into all of that. Let's start with the big questions. So what is the global or structural context for beverage alcohol?
So right now, if we go back to last year, so 2023, for TBA, so for total beverage alcohol globally, there was a volume decline of 1% and a value increase of plus 3%. So marginal premiumization still happening. Again, that's according to IWSR. If we're looking what we're forecasting and seeing this year, pretty flat. Pretty flat in terms of total volume, declines in some areas, and really a reduction or a moderation in the premiumization that we've seen, have all been seeing over the last couple of years.
Do you want to talk about why that's happening? I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people. A lot of people think, you know, we've seen it all before. It's cyclical. Other people are saying, no, it's structural. This is the new normal. What's your opinion on why? Why this is happening and if it's structural or cyclical?
It's a great question on terms of structural or cyclical, and actually an unhelpful answer, which is it's a bit of both.
Yeah, that is unhelpful, Luli.
Yeah. No, but I'm going to explain.
Get into the weeds.
I'm going to explain. So let's hopefully we'll kind of unpick that a little bit. One of the key structural changes, as we're all very much aware, those of us working in beverage alcohol, is an increase in moderation. So that is, there is a marginal increase in the proportion of adults globally who are abstaining totally from alcohol consumption. But actually, the reduction is coming more from those who remain alcohol consumers, but are just moderating the volume of alcohol, so the number of alcoholic beverages that they are consuming. So that's a really kind of key factor that is driving this overall structural volume decline in total beverage alcohol. So if we take markets, for example, like the US at the moment, amongst adults in the US, around 30% of adults are abstainers. In China, that's around 9%. So there are changes between markets in terms of the number of abstainers, moderators, reducers.
Okay, let's talk about that for a second. Is this a function of the fact that people who drink alcohol is getting older, or is something else happening that's driving this moderation?
So it's really interesting to talk about demographics. We hear a lot talked about in our industry about younger consumers not embracing wine, younger consumers not embracing alcohol overall. So yes, both of those things are happening. So again, if we let's take an example market, Germany. Amongst the adult population, 24% of German adults of legal drinking age abstain from alcohol. But if we look specifically at Gen Z, so the younger legal drinking age up into sort of early 20s, early to mid 20s now, that's 35%. So a third of those younger consumers in Germany. We compare that to the UK, we've got 18% of adults abstaining from alcohol, but nearly a third of Gen Z adults in the UK totally abstaining from alcohol.
And how is that different from previous generations?
So quite difficult to have accurate data on, in you know, going back 20 years, 50 years, you know, two different generations. I think there's a really interesting point here, which is, you know, I'm old enough and have been around in the beverage, alcohol and wine industry enough to know or remember the conversations we were having 20 years ago about, oh, my goodness me, millennials aren't embracing wine. What are we going to do? It's going to be a real problem. Now we look at the data, the people who are in the millennial generational cohort, so now in late 20s up into kind of early 40s, actually are amongst, in most mature and established markets, the consumers who are embracing wine the most. You know, they're drinking the most volume and typically at the highest price points.
Yeah, my first ever wine writing gig was for an American magazine called Gen X. And its premise was we have to get Gen X interested in wine because otherwise the market's going to collapse. So I saw the same thing happen again with the millennials. But there is some suggestion that, you know, the dangerous phrase, this time it's different, that this time it is different because of social media, because of smartwatches, so people can see what effect alcohol is having on them. What's your gut feeling? Do you think this time it is different, or do you think it's just a generational shift that will come around?
I think, yes, this time it is different in terms of relationship with alcohol. You know, how much we're drinking, when we're drinking, when we're consuming alcohol. So that doesn't just impact wine, it impacts across, you know, TBA, across all beverage alcohol categories. The evidence we have so far, and remembering that, you know, when we're talking about Gen Z, you know, they're only recently coming into legal drinking age, certainly in markets like the US, you know, it's kind of early days to be able to forecast, you know, are their behaviours going to change? But structurally, their behaviour is different.
I mean, in some ways, this is an uncomfortable conversation. I've had a lot of conversations about this, which are based on, you know, how do we get younger people drinking alcohol? And you know, when you hear it outside the wine industry, you think, oh, it's probably a good thing, you know, from a health perspective that people are drinking a lot less. But do you have any sense of where this will go in the sense of will people be off alcohol forever, or as they move into the workforce and dinners and stuff become part of their life, are they likely to take it up? What's your feeling?
Yeah, and again, I think that, you know, if we think back to what we were just talking about, the sort of 20 years ago, 25 years ago, you know, everybody was lamenting the issue of millennials not consuming wine. And now, as they are moving into different life stage, you know, family, settling down, partners, et cetera, socialising more at home rather than out of home. Actually, wine has become more part of their socialising, their lifestyle. So I think we will see some of that with Gen Z as they change in their life stage. But there will always be this kind of underlying principle that as a generational cohort, they are consuming alcohol less frequently.
Okay, so we've talked about wine. How is this playing out in other beverage alcohol categories like ready-to-drink, spirits, things like that, beer?
Yeah, so again, if we look at the sort of overall market for beverage alcohol, as I referred to earlier from IWSR, there is a global decline in the volume of alcohol that is being consumed. If we look at the areas where we're seeing growth, they continue to be in the premium, super premium, luxury in spirits and in beer and in wine. So the growth is still coming from, even though that kind of premiumization isn't as strong as we had seen in the last couple of years, that growth in all categories is still coming from the premium sectors. RTDs, you mentioned, yes, really strong growth, but let's remember the proportion of serves of beverage alcohol that RTD accounts for relatively is still quite small of the total serves of beverage alcohol. So although we've seen, you know, 50% growth in across a number of years, that's still a relatively small number of serves category compared to beer, particularly spirits and wine.
All right, so let's talk about the premium and super premium category for a moment. One of the things I've heard from a number of people who work in auction houses and fine wine is that they're actually seeing younger people than they've ever seen historically. They're starting to see the 28 to 40-year-olds, whereas, you know, collecting used to be for the over 40s. And one of the things they're suggesting is that it's actually technology that is bringing people into the luxury sector because people can see on their phones the prices of things, they can trade fractions and so on. Do you have any data around this?
Yeah, so again, what we're seeing at IWSR is similar trend, which is that the engagement with the trading side of wine, collecting side of wine, is the age is significantly shifting younger. So moving down to those now in the sort of, you know, sort of upper end of millennial cohort and Gen X to a certain extent. But yeah, that's absolutely supported by what we're seeing in the data. And again, back to the previous comment I made about that, again, amongst our millennial population, they are actually, you know, proportionally our most frequent wine drinkers and typically the wine drinkers that are spending most per bottle. So that correlates very clearly, again, with the kind of auction houses, the collecting, and as you say, with that kind of increased accessibility to be able to be part of that world.
Okay, so when you look across this landscape, you're talking about drops of 20% and so on. Are there any bright spots apart from premium and super premium? Like if you're a small to medium-sized business in wine or beer or spirits, what should you be thinking about right now in order to make sure that you're not one of the 20% that goes down the plug hole?
Yeah, well, I think if we, you know, we can talk about beer and wine and spirits, but if I particularly focus on wine, but in the context of beer and spirits, because I think the message is, or the thought process is still the same, which is that we're at kind of a structural inflection point, particularly for wine at the moment. If we roll the clock back, as you and I know, and I'm sure everybody listening to this, you know, wine's been around quite a long time. You know, it's a product that we've grown, you know, we've had our vineyards, we've made wine, we've vinified, we've had wine for a really long time. The structural strategy of wine businesses, if you want to think about it like that, has typically been small-scale farming agricultural businesses that have then sold their product to neighbours and local market. And that's how historically the wine industry has been.
Mm. Yeah.
What's really different now is that we're in a global marketplace. And this structural focus on product still exists in wine businesses. Now, we know why that is, because it's really hard to grow grapes and to make wine every year, you know, and we have the joys of climate change, of weather impacts, of disease pressure, you name it, that just makes us as wine businesses so centrally focused on the product, so being product-oriented businesses. Because we have to, because it's really difficult, you know, and just as an aside, you know, I took the, fourth step of three, nearly 4 years ago, of planting my own vineyard, you know, having talked about wine for more than 30 years, I thought I ought to roll my sleeves up and actually understand what this is all about. And, you know, in my very small 12 acres of Pinot Noir in the UK, you know, I am seeing it firsthand in a very small scale how hard it is, how variable it is, and how difficult it is to have that consistency because we're impacted by so much in when we're making wine. So the point here is really that wine businesses still, majority of them still remained product-centric businesses, so product-oriented businesses. If we think about global marketplaces and the fact that we're now selling wine, not just to our neighbours or our friends down the road or in our local community, we're selling it within our countries, across markets, and competing with producers from all around the world, then the structural organisation of wine businesses, in my opinion, needs to be market-oriented, not product-oriented.
You know, I've written about this for 20 years. And in 20 years, you know, I go to conferences and we all talk about this and everyone nods their heads and nobody actually does it. But now it's an emergency. So what's your top advice that you give to people now when you go in and consult them? How do you turn it to be market-oriented versus product-oriented?
Well, it's starting at the top. So the leadership, the owners, and particularly with the viticulturalists and the winemakers. And when I talk about market orientation, that's not to say that those parts of the business aren't crucial and key. We know that that is. But it's about a kind of cultural shift to say we have to put our customers' and our consumers' needs, values, and ultimately, therefore, what they are going to pay for at the heart of our business and at the heart of how we develop our business and our strategy. So for the businesses I work with, it's, you know, it's kind of tough talk, which is, you know, this needs to change. And change in any organisation is really hard. And it's particularly hard when the existing strategy, the existing way of focus has been there for tens, hundreds, thousands of years previously. So we're asking wine businesses to shift their focus from everything being centered around production to everything being centered around what do our customers and our consumers value so that they will pay for our stuff.
I'm just going to jump in with something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, which is that if you look at some of the New World countries or regions which were very market focused, they're now in terrible trouble. And in fact, some of the people within those regions, like particularly if you look at Australia and you look at Southeast Australia, some of the people within those regions that actually ditched the whole market paradigm and went into sort of artisanal winemaking are the ones who are surviving economically now. So how would you suggest that people become market-oriented without falling into that trap of, you know, being commercial winemakers? Because it does seem like the artisanal winemakers at the moment are actually doing economically quite well.
Yeah, and that's such a good point, because when I talk about market orientation, that doesn't mean I'm thinking only about, as you say, kind of commercial or mainstream wine. So your example there of, you know, our friend, the artisanal winemaker in Southeast Australia, they are being absolutely market focused. They have market orientation because they understand that their target consumer typically are going to be those probably based in South Australia, maybe in other states, but more local, more premium products where they can have a direct DTC relationship with their consumers. And probably, I'm imagining our lovely friends in Southeast Australia probably have, you know, really developed wine tourism and wine clubs. So that is being market oriented because it is about bringing the needs of the target consumers in centrally into the business.
Yeah, it's funny. I was in South Africa earlier this year, and I went to visit some of the wineries, which are, you know, renowned as being fine wines and artisanal wines. And some of the people running those are very commercially minded. You know, it's like, you know, it's like musicians like to hide how much they practice. They just want you to believe that they're kind of geniuses, and it all just happened by itself.
Yeah.
So let's go back a step. So now you're consulting, but you've got a long history in wine research. How did you start in the first place? How did you get into this?
Well, the story goes back a very long way, which is back to my childhood. And
you weren't drinking wine in your childhood,
no,
were you?
No,
shame
no, no.
On
I'm
your
going
parents.
To be, you know, my parents would were very responsible, clearly. But when I was young, when I was a child, we didn't have very much money as a family. So summer holidays were camping for us. That's what we could do. And we used to pile all of the camping gear into the back of the car and drive to France and typically spend quite rainy days on campsites in France. But on the way home, we always routed through Burgundy because my dad was a wine fan. He loved wine. So we always stopped in Burgundy and filled up the car with as much wine as we could fit in, which typically meant my brother and I with wine under our elbows, under our feet and everywhere else you can imagine. And again, back in those days, which was kind of pre-Brexit and the previous era, you had to declare wine, you had to declare alcohol when you brought it into the UK. So Dad would spend ages with the customs guy talking about the various Burgundies he bought as he was paying the duty on that, bringing it into the UK. So I kind of became aware of this glorious thing called wine and the places that wine came from. Fast forward the clock, we didn't do anything to do with wine, did a degree in something different, went off and worked for an engineering consultancy, and then took a sort of late gap year in Australia. Rediscovered wine again and realised, actually, this stuff is made all around the world. By then I was of legal drinking age and started to really enjoy it. So then when I came back from Oz, I worked for an importer for 4 years in the UK, and then what at the time was the biggest UK retailer, and just fell in love with this product and the opportunity to work in the industry. So when I had my son 25 years ago, I went back to uni to do a degree in market research and consumer behaviour. Because I realised that actually this product category that I loved and was passionate about was not really very good at understanding consumers and researching them. So that's why I started Wine Intelligence post my degree. So since then, I've just always had this.
And the field was yours because there's still not very much sort of high quality research around. It's interesting, actually. So, yeah, so was there resistance at the beginning? Did wine businesses actually realise they needed this kind of work?
The honest answer is probably no. And the honest answer today is, do they realise it today? Probably no. Have I, in my career, faced resistance? Yes, I always try to do my advisory consulting work, talk about research with a positive smile on my face and hopefully in a constructive way, because I'm passionate about our category and our industry. And ultimately, I want wine businesses to be successful. You know, that's what I want.
So did you start Wine Intelligence?
So I started Wine Intelligence, gosh, back in 24 years ago, 23 years ago.
Okay, so you've seen the rapid expansion of the wine industry and now, I guess, the contraction. It was interesting. I read a book which affected me a lot when I was at university. It was called The Empty Raincoat by Charles Handy. He was an economist, and he said all businesses live on the bell curve and they have about 40 years. And when you get to the top of the bell curve, that's the moment that you're supposed to change what you do, because if you don't change, you're inevitably going to go down the other side. And he said, but most people get to the top of the bell curve and they go, look where I've landed. I must be doing something right. And so they stay with what they're doing. And I'm thinking, if you think of the modern wine industry as starting around 1982, which is when Robert Parker made his predictions about Bordeaux, it's pretty much 40 years since the expansion, and now we're down the other side of the bell curve. So looking back, what do you think are some of the decisions that could have been made that weren't made? I know that's a question out of left field, but it's just occurred to me.
Yeah, no, it's such a good example that you, or illustration that you give there on this kind of bell curve. And I guess that's what we were talking about earlier, which is we're on the downward slope. So now, you know, unless businesses do change now, then, you know, that slippery slope is going to continue. So I think the decisions about planting.
Okay, interesting.
For me, could we wind the clock back, you know, for example, to when I started Wine Intelligence? Could we have predicted that we would move more to lower ABV, particularly in red wines, as a majority market? Clearly, there are still consumers for higher ABV, fuller-bodied wines. Would we have predicted dry style rosé? Could we have predicted Sauvignon Blanc, for example, Pinot Grigio, and the move to sparkling? So those type, and overall, that's really embracing this idea of wellness, moderation, typically because it's lower ABV, but also the kind of structural change that we've seen in beverage alcohol towards refreshment.
Yeah, I mean, some of that has to do with the weather getting hotter, which we were told about, but I don't think anybody believed. And the other one, of course, is the mass movement of women, yes, into beverage alcohol. That's been a massive change as well. So in terms of branding and in terms of marketing and in terms of marketing decisions, what do you think people haven't done that they should be doing right now?
I think so if we talk about branding and branding decisions, you know, all of the discussion in the world of marketing science over the last 10, 15 years has centered around distinctiveness versus differentiation. So how do you position your brands? If we kind of go back into, you know, the original marketing theory, the likes of Kotler, who, by the way, I'm still a big fan of, Acker, people like that, really we were talking about brands for how do you position and differentiate your brand. And that was really what the discussion was about. Over the last 5-10 years, particularly, you know, Byron Sharp et al, you know, has really been focusing and using data to understand actually that distinctiveness is the key driver of brand growth. So the reason I sort of tell that story, actually, my view is it's, you know, again, an annoying answer, which is it's both and. We need distinctiveness and some differentiation. But if you think about differentiation in wine, that's really hard. You know, differentiated wine brand cannot be a wine brand that is family owned, that has won awards, and it's really good quality. And most wine businesses, wine brands, have focused on those three things or a combination or similar to say, oh, we're differentiated because. And no, we're not. But, you know, pretty much most wine businesses can get quite close to those claims today. So that is not true differentiation.
Okay, let me stop you. Just to say, I'm a you didn't realize this about me, Lily, but I've got my own winery. I've just got one.
Congratulations.
And I've called. Thank you. Yes, it's a bit of a financial burden, but I'm hoping to turn it around. So I've called you in, and I go, look, my wine is made in the vineyard and it's made with passion, but I would like to be distinctive. Talk me through how you discover the distinctive attributes that might help me in the market.
Yeah, so distinctiveness, a lot of that, again, the wine makers and that side of the business probably don't want to hear me talk about this, but that is to do with label, design, what the consumer sees. You know, that's our advert. That's the bit that consumers will identify when they're, you know, the salience at the point of purchase. And they'll recognize. So it's how do we reassure? So we still need reassuring wine cues in our branding, but have those distinctive brand assets, which mean that consumers go, oh yeah, I recognize that. I know that. I'll just pick that off the shelf. If I can just go back a step on that one, again, you know, wine businesses don't appreciate me for saying this, you know, my sort of truth out there bit, which is most people who consume wine around the world really don't care that much about it. It's not a big thing. They just want a refreshing or full-bodied beverage, alcoholic beverage experience. It is not a fundamental and structural part of most consumers' lives. So to get that headspace in our fast brain, slow brain, we really need to have ways of just helping consumers remember our brands. So for me, it's how do you create those distinctive brand assets and be consistent with them?
So how would you help somebody like me with my newly inherited winery, because I inherited it? How would you help me discover my distinctiveness?
So again, it's, you know, it's working with you to understand what your history is, what your legacy is. Maybe you're a new business like I am with my winery. I don't have legacy and history. You know, we've only had the vineyard for 4 years. But what is it that I can portray or can communicate that is memorable but is also important to my target audience? So if I give an example, maybe your winery, let's imagine your winery is a bit like the one I've got in the UK, and you've got Pinot Noir there.
How did you know? So that's true, I do.
There you go.
You'll tell
us. So you've got Pinot Noir, you've got 24 acres rather than my 12 acres, let's say. You've got 24 acres of Pinot Noir. What are you going to do with that? Well, how about, let's think about premium rosé, because you've only got 24 acres. You're not going to be large scale. You're going to have high costs of production, I'm afraid, Felicity. You've probably inherited that from your mother.
What? Uncle Bob didn't tell me about that.
Uncle Bob. So you're going to have to sell your wine at premium price points. So...
Oh. Well, I like the idea of being posh. Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to sell your wine at premium price points. So let's work through this. How are you going to do that? Well, the Pinot Noir is going to be pretty difficult. Where's your winery?
Oh, it's here in Germany. So it's in a... So my problem, Lily, is it's in a village that nobody in the English-speaking world is going to be able to pronounce.
Yeah, fine. So we don't...
Actually, this is a problem for German wineries generally. So if you can help me solve the problem, you can solve the national problem.
Fine. So let's, in the nicest possible way, let's not worry about your village name and where you come from, but let's think about what you can do with the Pinot Noir grapes that you can sell at premium price points, primarily in Germany and probably to a few key export markets. If we are a market-oriented business, what we're then going to do is say, okay, what do consumers want? What are they paying premium price points for today? What are they going to pay premium price points for in 5 years? So working with you, I would say, okay, let's do rosé only. Let's only make rosé wine, and let's make the majority of it in magnums, Felicity. Because you can be...
Oh, you're scaring me. My Uncle Bob didn't believe in magnums. This is overturning tradition,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, well, you're at the inflection point. You're down the slippery slope, Felicity. Uncle Bob's handed it over to you. So, you know, it's that change moment.
Do you know, I've got to tell you this story. One of my... one of the women I know who was a winemaker here, she was one of the first women to study winemaking, and her uncle had a winery, and he said, no woman is going to work in my winery except over my dead body. And he died, and now she's got the winery.
Well, there you go. Yes. Well, yeah, that could well be my story. It's a good story, but in all seriousness, actually, if we're talking about kind of trends and understanding consumer needs and being market-oriented, actually being more diverse in terms of understanding the broader diversity of our consumer base and having more diversity representation in the employees, the family team, whoever it is in the wine business, actually is pretty important for success going forward. Where if we think about where we're seeing the small pockets of where we're seeing growth in wine globally, typically, those are in developing or non-traditional consumption markets.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So the consumer's mindset, experience set, what else they've grown up, what types of flavours, you know, in food and in drink that they are used to, is going to be different. You know, I'm thinking of an example from many years ago at Wine Intelligence when we were testing taste descriptors for red wines amongst Chinese consumers. And of course, you know, my stupidity, my naivety was not, it was a lack of understanding that, you know, some flavour descriptions just don't translate because they're not part of the sort of native repertoire of flavours. So it's that idea of just being kind of cognizant and open-minded to the fact that, you know, that consumers in different parts of the world, even within different countries and different age groups, are coming at our category with a different set of references for which they're understanding our product.
Yeah. All right. So let's go back to my, because I want to talk about me. Let's go back to my magnums of rosé. Of course, that's a big decision and most people would need some outside help or they would need outside research before they did that kind of thing. For most wineries, it's probably out of the budget. So if you're a small to medium-sized winery and you don't have lots of resources, where do you go for information on how you should make your sort of decisions?
There is actually an awful lot you can do, but it's about investing the time and changing the mindset so that it becomes a priority in your business. The joy of now versus even 20 years ago is that, you know, so much information is available at our fingertips. There is so much information simply on the Google search or increasingly through AI. So it's about, you know, what I say to the businesses I'm working with or to small, medium-sized businesses is there is so much information about consumers, about trends, about market conditions already available. You know, even at IWSR, for example, you know, we're putting out stories and newsletters and infographics every day, every week, as are all the other research agencies and data and information. So if you just gather that in and start to understand it. The other thing I would say is do your own research. You know, that talk, to, you know, engage your sales force if you have one around your country, your importers, your distributors, your wholesalers. I always say to people, go and sit in bars and look at people. Slightly weird thing to say, but, you know, go into a bar, look at, just observe, you know, what are people ordering? How are they ordering it? You know, don't get kind of caught out by security guards in stores for being weird, but, you know, hang out.
Yeah, don't get caught.
Don't get caught, but hang out in the wine aisle, hang out in the beverage aisle. I do that everywhere I go, you know, and just look at what's on the shelves. How long are people spending there? What are they picking up? What are they looking at? Are they just staying on the end cap? Are they going down the aisles? Is it obvious that they're just heading for that distinctive brand that, you know, at that salient point, or are they browsing the shelves? You can learn so much from just doing that. And if you imagine you've got your wholesaler, your importer, your team all going out doing that and then coming back together and sharing what you've learned, supported by your secondary data analysis through AI, Google, etc., you'll know so much more if you do that process than probably what you know today. The other big point is all of us, myself included, we are the worst people to have an opinion about what branding or wine should be or look like. You know, as I've said earlier, I'm passionate about wine and the wine industry. I'm not like a wine consumer. I'm paid to do this for my job, as are all of us that work in the sector. So we are not normal relative to wine consumers. So it's about not overlaying our own opinion and our own experiences and actually just being humble enough to say, I'm going to listen and observe the reality of those people who are putting their hands in their pockets, in their wallets and their pocketbooks to actually buy the products.
So we've talked about small and medium-sized businesses, but actually some of the large businesses are struggling as well. We've just seen a very spectacular bankruptcy. We've seen the big companies trying to get rid of many of their brands. What sort of decisions should they be taking that they haven't been?
So in that area, so we're talking about, as you say, the kind of other sector of the industry. I think the, if I can, I think there's been a naive, some business naivety, particularly over the last couple of years when we saw the kind of, you know, excessive, but strong growth in beverage alcohol total, but also in wine during COVID. And then we've seen the overstocking problem coming through, certainly in the last 12 months, potentially more in spirits than in wine, but there's certainly a overstocking when it comes to wine. There's been, as we know, overextension, particularly going into higher interest rate in borrowing rate environments, and probably a kind of false sense of security, to a bit like you were talking about earlier, this sort of top of the bell curve. And maybe the result of that is actually not then being forward thinking and just kind of living off today rather than planning for tomorrow.
Okay, what do you think about this? I've been talking to people about premiumization, and I have heard one theory that maybe premiumization did some of the damage because people came in at maybe the $12 to $15 mark, and some of the interesting wines moved out of that because they were all trying to get to $15, leaving really sort of drab, very commercial wines available at those lower price points. And as somebody said to me, when everybody premiumizes, what you get is inflation. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think that's true, but I would put a kind of but in there, which is, again, for us as wine industry, if we can call you and I wine industry professionals, people kind of working in that sector, what we think or believe is a good quality wine, maybe or maybe not what our typical consumer thinks is a good quality wine. You know, and we know all of the studies that have been done on taste analysis, taste preference. You know, for example, you know, you put the same liquid in a bottle that appears and looks German, the same liquid goes into a bottle that appears and looks French. You ask consumers to rank and rate the quality and the taste and the preference. And typically, depending, unless you're in Germany, typically outside of Germany, you will see that experiment, that very famous piece of research that's been done, shows that you get significantly higher ratings and value scores for the wine that appears to the consumer to be French over German. It's the same liquid.
I didn't know that. I've never heard that. When was that done? No, I haven't. That's a complete revelation, Lily. When was that done?
I would have to find the date. It's quite old. It's a study that's been done quite a while ago. And even at Wine Intelligence, we did similar studies where we were putting the same liquid in different packaging. We didn't, you know, we just said, here's two wines, tell us what you think. We didn't kind of go explicitly, you know, this is Chilean, this is Australian, or this is Cabernet Sauvignon, this is Merlot. So you leave consumers to just kind of say, here's, you know, two wines, three wines, four wines, you know, tell us what you think and kind of rate them and rank them. So I think there is a gap between expert view of what makes a good wine and a consumer view of what makes a good wine.
See, I think the conclusion to draw from what you've just said is that I need to plaster French-looking labels all over my magnums of Pinot Noir. I think that's the clear outcome
there. When we were talking about that, do you remember I said, don't worry about the fact that what your village name is or where you come from? If you think, you know, let's take a classic example, Whispering Angel. You know, is it the first thing people think of as French? Maybe, maybe not. It's got not a French sounding name. It's very clear. It's very distinctive. You know, it kind of plays on its Provençal or French cues as a secondary positioning. But actually, it's just about being this kind of cool, emotional, connecting brand with a name like Whispering Angel that people have affinity to. You know, that's why they're buying it. Most people are buying Whispering Angel for that reason.
Oh, right. So tell me, your vineyard, what made you buy it, knowing everything that you do about the wine trade and how difficult it is? Why did you buy it and what are you intending to do? Are you going to make your own wine or are you going to sell the grapes?
Yeah, so we didn't buy it. We inherited a farm that was a...
Oh, right, so you've got an Uncle Bob
as well. Yes, I've got Uncle Bob, but it was a sheep farm. And I have to say that my affinity to sheep is not that high, and my knowledge of how to farm them is even less. So there was a kind of decision gate for us, which was, you know, kind of what do we do with this asset that, you know, lovely Uncle Bob has left to us as a legacy. So I guess the natural choice for us was let's plant a vineyard and see what happens.
And what happened to the sheep?
So we still do actually have some sheep, but just fewer sheep than we had. Interestingly, actually, I was obsessive about putting the sheep into the vineyard to do the overwinter grazing, which we did this year and worked really successfully. And we also ran an experiment with our sheep fleeces, because sheep fleeces have no value in the UK and actually you have to pay somebody to take them away. So we took them up into the vineyard and laid them under vine, just as a kind of weed barrier. And actually in the second year now since we did that, the rows we've done that on, we've had less weed growth coming through in year two. So we've been able to reduce our chemical usage.
Why is that? Is it the lanolin in the wool?
Yeah, it's a protective barrier. And because the sheep wool fleeces biodegrade, as you said, relatively slowly. So it's just managed to... And the other advantage we've had is because we're on quite heavy clay soil, it's prevented the cracking during the hotter period and kept the moisture in. So lots of benefits.
So what are you going to do with the grapes?
So at the moment we have a grape contract, which runs for another couple of years. So I think come talk to me in 2 years' time when we're at that point to say, do we renew our contract or do we make our own wine?
Okay, so let's talk about that now, because another pain point that's happening is in the UK. A lot of people planted grapes and now it looks like there's not necessarily a home for them. So what do you see ahead for the UK or for the English wine industry?
Yeah.
Your grapes, of course, will sell. It goes without saying. But when you remark upon everybody else, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think there's still the area under planted, as you say, has significantly grown in the UK in the last 10 years. But so has awareness for English sparkling wine and the number or proportion of consumers who have strong affinity for particularly English sparkling wine, but increasingly still wine as well. As champagne prices are continuing to increase, you know, the differential is making English sparkling wine more positive. I'm predicting, imagining, I don't know, but I would imagine that we're going to see more consolidation because being a relatively new part of the industry, you know, typically we're subscale, a bit like I am. So, you know, that is not going to be profitable long term. So I think really what we're going to see is consolidation. And then when we have that consolidation, we'll get kind of stronger brands coming through, stronger salience coming through. And let's not forget, you know, it's from small beginnings, humble beginnings, English wine, particularly English sparkling wine, is increasingly being exported. So there is kind of an opportunity in export markets as well.
Okay, let's do a quick lightning round about some of the opportunities that are wine adjacent. So there's a lot of sales of wine spritzers at the moment. Is this just a momentary trend, or do you think it's something that if people have extra wine, they should think about seriously?
I would say think about seriously. If we look again back to previous conversation or we were having about moderation and reduction in alcohol consumption combined with changing consumption occasions and moments for alcohol, combined with refreshment, all of those lead to kind of RTD style opportunity. So that there is definitely the opportunity from a trend point of view for spritz style wines. We have seen that in the past. It is a bit cyclical, like you were talking about earlier. You know, it might not be the kind of long, it's not going to be the long-term saviour of this 20% reduction, but for individual wineries, it might make that difference in terms of kind of ROI and capital investment.
Okay, non-alc wine. What do you think about that category?
Again, an area that many wine businesses don't like me to say, but I'm simply here as the reporter for all consumers. I don't see a strong opportunity for low or zero alcohol still wine. Sparkling, more of an opportunity. If you think about sparkling occasions, sparkling wine occasions, often they're celebratory, with other people, social. So the idea of popping a cork for a low or particularly no alcohol sparkling, you can still raise your glass, you can still be kind of part of the social group, even if you're drinking a no alcohol sparkling wine. So I think although it's a very small category, there is still quite a strong opportunity from a small base. The primary issue, as we know, with still wine and low and no alc is flavour and how difficult it is to do.
So I've been speaking to producers and I was surprised to learn that people talking about non-alc sparkling sell to the halal market and not in the Middle East. It's to here in Europe so that people can participate, as you said. But the problem, so I've drunk a lot of non-alc wine now, and what strikes me about nearly all of it is it all, I don't mean this as pejorative, but it tastes the same. There's something about the alcohol removal process that I would be, I think I've got a reasonable palate and I would be very hard pressed to tell between one and the other. And that's having drunk quite a lot of them now. All right. So maybe that's not a long-term future, but many wineries now are moving into distilling their own gins and stuff as another way of getting profit. What do you think about that? Do you think that is realistic for many wineries?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned gin there because talk about sort of cyclical and cycles. Again, if we look at IWSR data, the gin category having boomed is not booming in the way that it was. And we now see, for example, we have seen up to now tequila and to a certain extent mezcal and whiskey of all types kind of taking market share from gin and to a certain extent from brandy or cognac as well. So there again, it depends. If it's you and your Uncle Bob's vineyard, and you're having a sort of DTC relationship with consumers, you've got tourism going on, then having that as part of what you're selling DTC to your consumers could be a good way of realizing cash flow from that. Entering the spirits market, again, like wine, spirits is more constrained or more competition than we have seen previously. So trying to be a new entrant as a wine supplier going into spirits, it requires a different, as we know, often a different distribution system, different points of sale, and different investment from that point of view. So that can make it quite tricky.
Tell you one thing that really interested me when I was working in the US is realizing how different national tastes around spirits are. Like the Americans are tequila drinkers and the UK are gin drinkers, and yet all of the wine trends get adopted internationally fairly fast. They're drinking Burgundy in Hong Kong and they're drinking Burgundy in New York, but that's not true of spirits at all. Do you have any insights into why that is?
I think primarily it's because, if we go to the kind of history of distillation and spirits and how that category has been developed, again, most countries in the world have produced their own local spirits. So whether it's soju or baijiu or cachaça or whatever it is, there is typically a local spirit produced, distilled from local, often, local product. So the culture of spirits has been about that local, and that's what's dominated the markets up to 50 years ago, even 20 years ago, even now in some places. So this globalization of spirits, of Scotch whiskey or bourbon, or is now globalizing, but each market, many markets are still strongly dominated by their local spirit. Although, we are seeing a change away from that. But again, what's quite interesting is even in the last year or two, we're seeing premiumization of those local spirits, which typically have become kind of lower price points, lower value, as consumers are kind of thinking more local and wanting to experience more local products. So actually we're seeing, Baijiu, for example, in China, actually premiumizing.
Interesting. All right. So we've been talking for quite a while now across a range of subjects. Final thoughts, given that we'll go back to wine, given that wine is going into some very tough times, apart from hiring you to come and sort out their problems, what piece of advice or insight would you leave people with?
I would say to any wine business, invest your time and energy in understanding what your consumers and customers value and will value through the ways I talked about earlier, rather than and expecting everything to just carry on as it has done for the last 5, 10 or 20 years, because it won't. So I think there's a kind of, you can put your hands over your eyes or your fingers in your ears and go, I'm just going to carry on doing what I'm doing because I've just got to, because that's, I'm sort of stuck in this loop. Or I can really, we can challenge ourselves as a business to say, what do people value? Because ultimately that's what matters for a sustainable financial business. If you've got products that people value, they will pay for them. And that's what we need to happen.
All right. On that note, thank you very much, Luli.
You're welcome, Felicity.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.